Nine men manipulate the control.
Namaste Sarasati Devi Gurvani Bhattarine. Jai Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda.
So, the topic today is
a little unusual,
but we'll
finish it
by the mercy of Mandara and crew.
Another book
that we hope to have out called Transforming Lust into Love. Second spiritual warrior.
In this book, we're looking, you know, dynamically at
love versus lust.
And looking from that aspect.
From things in relationship to two relationships, relationship also to
sex.
And in that spirit, I thought it would be nice if I do an offering which is going to go into the beggar book. Right after we finish translation,
we're going to
work on the beggar book. So, I wanted to speak a little bit about material sex life versus spiritual union, with the hopes that maybe we might use some of this as the last part of our book. A little amendment to the last chapter. And first let me say, it is difficult to speak on the topic that I'm going to try to address because of several reasons. First reason is that we're going to look at something that may be called spiritual sex. Now I cannot be understood, because you can't understand spiritual union and be in a conditioned state. So there's one school of thought that says you don't discuss such things because people can't understand it anyway, and they'll just think that it's material sex, or they'll look at it only in regards to how they normally view things, and it will simply be a disturbance, or it can simply lead to confusion. There's another school of thought that says, perhaps we talk about it to a certain extent, because by talking about it, if the speaker understands the subject matter, and the speaker is bona fide, then the speaker can talk about it, even though the audience will not understand it. It will plant seeds in consciousness, and it will help the person to be able to understand it at some point more expediently than they would, or they help them to understand what they normally wouldn't be able to understand at all. So in other words, to try to qualify that, we want to discuss a topic that normally you don't talk about, because the tendency is that people will relate to it or think about it in paradigms that are unhealthy. But we're going to talk about it to help you to understand why you can't understand it, so that in the future you'll be able to understand it. If that would make any sense. So let us hope that we can be the second aspect, that as we talk a little about these things, that speaker, hopefully being genuine, or by mercy of Guru and Krishna, then the way that it will be discussed will not bring on mundane conceptions, excessive mundane conceptions, but will allow one to be in awe and anticipation to grow for self-realization. So we start, so this is material sex life versus spiritual union. First, we want to remind ourselves that spiritual life versus material life, it's not that material life is not real, but spiritual life is real. is that spiritual life is sanatana, or eternal. And material life is temporary. It's reflections of something that is real. So if the real thing exists, better to say it like this. If a reflection can exist, then it means the real thing is also in existence. When you see an image, you can understand an image or a reflection or a replica or something that is artificial posits the existence of a genuine entity or thing. So material world, material body, material relationships, material interactions, they are all part of the temporary, or they're all part of the reflection. They're all part of the transitory, but it's not that they are non-existing or they're not real, because even an illusion is a reality. That we say material world is illusory. So it's an illusion, but the illusion itself is a reality. It's an illusion of something. It is in existence. Illusion is also having existence. It may not be the thing of its own, the thing of itself. But if I have a dream that I'm eating an apple. Well, I may not in fact be eating an actual tangible apple, but my dream is a reality of itself. That I'm genuinely having a dream where I'm reflecting on, or I'm having some mental gymnastic of putting an apple and putting it in my mouth and eating it. So it's a reality, not of its own in its essence, but it is a reality but it is a type of reality. So we can't have sex life in the material world, in material universes, and it's just categorized something that's just an illusion. It's not the real connection. It's like the body itself is limited and it's experiencing certain things in relationships based on the fact that the soul is an eternal pure relationship with the Supreme. So if we look at it in that sense, we can gradually lay some groundwork for trying to understand what we can't understand. So if the illusion is there, we see an image of something in the river or in the mirror, and we understand the image is a reflection of something that is actually existing somewhere that's causing the image, causing the reflection. That reflection has certain attributes of the real thing because the real thing is existing. If you think about it, the way modern society is functioning, most people think of sex every single day. And many people, many times doing every single day. So something that people are reflecting on so much is the reality that's being reflected upon or engaged in. But it is a reflection of something that is extremely sublime. So in our discussion of lust versus love, it automatically, organically draws us to look at such things, because we see one of the highest expressions in the material body of a love connection is sex. And so that is a perversion of the highest connection of the soul in its rapture with the divine soul, or with the ultimate source of all souls. Now, Krishna says himself in Bhagavad Gita, I am that sex according to religious principles. So even the sex life in the material body can be performed in consciousness, that even that takes on a liberating aspect. So that even the illusion or the perversion can be engaged in based on the limited situation that one is in the material body, basically tuning into only material vibrations, material conditions, material stimulation, that even that can be engaged in a way that it doesn't bring on more and more complexities of the illusion, or doesn't compound the illusion. And we will explain that as we go through. So that's first kind of what we want to lay down. Second thing we want to establish is just who we are. We are Vaishnavas. And what is Vaishnava? Vaishnava is one who has a monotheistic conception of worship. That is the conception that there is one God, not a polytheistic, that there are many gods. There are many devas, there are many demigods, there are many angels, there are many archangels, there are many super beings, Gandhavas, Apsaras, different types of extraterrestrial, different living entities on so many realms, in many different dimensions, in many planets, and within many planets. But there is one supreme God. In Sanskrit we say, one Parameshwara. There are many Ishvaras. Ishvara Paramakrishna, Satyadananda Vigraha, Anadi Nadi Govinda, Sarva Karma Karana. Lord Brahma, who is a very powerful being, who actually is what many people in lower religiosity call God, but he's actually the creator of the material universes. He explains that he himself, some may think that he is himself the Godhead, ultimate Godhead, but he emphasizes there is a supreme Godhead greater than himself. And of course, that is referring to Supreme Personality, Godhead, ultimate Godhead. We refer to him as Krishna, or the Simone Balam, the Absolute Truth. So, as Vaishnavas, we are worshippers of the one God. And so we are worshipping Krishna, worshipping Ram, or Vishnu, or in some cases giving reverence to all three, but realizing that there is one supreme God. So some Vaishnavas are more bhaktas, they have more heart for Krishna in a certain expression. Krishna in expression as a child. They have a certain mellow or flavor for Krishna as supreme controller. Some have more of a taste for Krishna as a supreme ruler, that is the worship of Lord Ram. Supreme autocrat, that is Vishnu. But Vaishnava is one who is worshipping Krishna, worshipping God in the idea of Krishna. Vaishnava also is very similar to Judaic and Christian orientation of Godhead, in contrast to other traditions connected with the other aspect of the Vedic tradition. That means looking at the general realm of Hinduism, normally there are worshippers of Shiva, Shaivites, or Shakti, of different energies, mystics, yogis. And so their conception is that God is energy, and that, or sometimes that there are many gods who are all of the same equal position. Brahma, Shiva, Ganesh, Durga, etc. So that is quite foreign to Christianity and Judaism, that honors that there is one God. But our Vaishnava line is more in harmony with Judaism and Christianity, or Islam, in that it emphasizes that there is ultimately one Supreme Lord. Now, not only are we in harmony, but we're in harmony, but we also have so much more detail about that Supreme God. And that's where they're taking. Now, there is a major difference, however, in the Vaishnava line, because not only are we Vaishnavas, we are what is called Gaudiya Vaishnavas. It's looked at in two ways. Sometimes it's explained based on the Lord Chaitanya, who we are honoring, who has come as the supreme descendant, that much of his preaching was in a certain area, what now is called India, in the Gaudiya area, or sometimes referred to, because later we went so far outside of that area, but also sometimes referred to from a metaphorical perspective, is that Gaur or Gaur is usually referred is a foodstuff. It's like sugar or melted. It's like honey or like jam. So Gaudiya Vaishnavas refer to those who are worshiping the one God, but in a special sweet mellow. Worshiping the one God in a special ras of sweetness. And so we'd say Gaudiya Vaishnava. So if we can appreciate those things, then it'll become easy for us to move to the third thing. So as Vaishnava is worshiping the one God, having a similarity with Christianity, Islam, Judaism. Same time having a serious difference, because we are about understanding that spiritual union. We are about the services of the Lord of different levels of intimacy, and even that what is called Madhurya versus Ashrama, Aishvara. Aishvara is worshiping God in a majestic way, more as just the autocrat, the supreme controller, destroyer, annihilator, etc. And Madhurya is worshiping supreme, but in confidentiality, a void of formality, with intimacy, etc. So when we try to understand something about spiritual sex or about spiritual union, then we are moving away from the Aishvara conception, the conception of God only as the supreme, which created everything, which maintained everything, who destroys everything, or the idea of God is many, many gods, or the idea of God is only, Shakti, or impersonal energy. To understand the deeper confidential aspect of spirituality, we see that it takes commitment and qualification. And that's not only in the Vaishnava life, but that we will find throughout theology in general. For instance, when we examine teachings like Judaism, we find this mystical or conjugal conception, relationship to the soul and its rapture with God. We find it in Christianity. We find it in all of the inner teachings of any bona fide tradition. For instance, in Judeo-Christian conception, we find the conception of bridal mysticism. On Judaism, we find the conception of becoming the spouse of God. Christianity becoming the bride of Christ. In certain nadaris, you take vow in such a way. You become the bride of Christ. So they take vow of celibacy, never to marry, but to become the bride of Christ. And we look at some of the mystic Christians, such as Saint Teresa of Avila. We look at St. John of the Cross, and we see in their lives that they describe a certain experience with the Godhead that is of a Madhurya or a conjugal status. They describe an experience of being the lover of God. Whether they're in a male or a female body, they describe the idea. Because they are presenting the theme as the soul being feminine in nature, ultimately, and that the soul being able to associate with the ultimate beloved. And even though we see it is not the Vaishnava tradition, but that this theme is consistent. But we only find it appearing at most advanced saints. We can say the topmost advanced saints in the various traditions have some inkling, some connection, some alignment with this aspect. It is not a common thing amongst religionists in terms of disgust or in terms of experience. So in the Vaishnava line we have what is called Vaidhi Bhakti versus Raganuga mysticism. Vaidhi Bhakti is the, again, is the awness, thinking of God in reverence and in awe. And Raganuga mysticism is the spontaneity, or the even more than the ecstasy, different levels of ecstasy that grade into even higher, Bhav or Mahabhav. So, both give a different level of love of God. The love of the Vaidhi is the practice of rules and regulations through Sadhana Bhakti. It is the practice where one is involved in certain rituals in certain form that gradually enhances the consciousness, controls the senses, and allows a person to be able to experience something about their original nature as a spiritual being. Often the Vaidhi Bhakti, when deeply performed, then makes the connection for the Raganuga Bhakti. The Raganuga Bhakti comes from one's own intense greed, loyam, dedication, but as much mercy or more mercy than just greed and just personal performance. Normally it's explained that it comes in connection with intense rigorous practice, intense greed, and intense blessing and association from a rasika bhakta, or from teacher or mentor who is on that platform, who is aware of such, their knowledge, their love is able to be is able to spill over, or they're able to help one to become imbibed with some seed of understanding that can grow and unfold. So, last one before we read this short presentation, because again, it's something that cannot be discussed so much because it's to be understood and known. And so normally it is not discussed much because the discussion you still don't understand. But still, it's in the literature, throughout the Vaishnava literatures and throughout the various traditions, even though it's not fully understood. Just like in the Bible, in the Song of Songs, the Song of Solomon, very few chapters in the Bible. I mean, one chapter, but very, very few verses. Very short, one of the shortest chapters. It's a few pages. So, theologians have tried to understand this, and it's totally bewildering, because it is the complete expression of one who is in the spirit of Madhurya, or in the spirit of relating to God or thinking of God in the mood of God being the Beloved. And it moves just like a romance tale, a deep romance tale. And so sometimes people try to describe it allegorically, and they say it is the allurement of every individual to sense gratification, or to Satan, or to sin. And based on that allurement, one should try not to play in to such. Or they refer to it as a discussion that is for every woman to be chaste in spite of temptation. You try to find ways to speak about it. And in the Jewish tradition, the song is read different times during Passover period. They try to evaluate it from an allegorical, but from a literal perspective, and from one who looks at it from a Vaishnava, or from the confidential aspect of the soul's union with the Lord, or from spiritual sex, then we understand it is not just an allegorical situation. It is a literal arrangement of where a very great entity is expressing their dedication to God over other types of relationships, dedications, associations, loving exchanges, experiences, etc. So, to understand all of that will make this make sense. If you didn't hear, didn't understand that, then there's no reason even to be here. You see by this discussion. So, one other last link. Now within that union of the soul versus material sex life is two lovers. And there's called Sambhoga versus Vipralamba. Sambhoga is the rapture of the soul in association with the beloved. And the Vipralamba is the, which is considered a deeper connection, is when there is separation, but there is complete meditation, contemplation on the beloved, complete reflection on previous experiences, complete reflection anticipation of the union. And therefore, the Vipralamba is considered to be even more powerful than the actual association. That also shows the tremendous difference between material sex gratification or sex life and spiritual union. Because in the material sense, the physical stimulation becomes pretty much the major emphasis. And here we're saying that the separation is even greater than the actual connection. So we just summarize again. So we're talking about, so we bring us in as we go over the short reading, that we're talking about something that cannot be understood, but we're speaking about it so that we can understand what we can understand. So we can prepare ourselves to understand somehow in the future. Different ways of looking at this is that it should not be talked about, because people will just refer to it in a mundane sense, or think about it in mundane reference and paradigms. Another school of thought is that it should be talked about if the speaker is qualified, because then the speaker can somehow plant the seed that allows the consciousness to later understand and develop. That to understand such things, to appreciate what you don't understand, what you can't understand, we have to look at just what spiritual life is, transcendental life in general. That the material world is a perverted reflection of the spiritual, that it is real, but it's an illusion. And so you can't have the desires of sex life, the activities of sex life, and just be something that is nothing. It is existing because the illusion is existing because the real thing is existing. So the artificial, the temporary, the illusion is a positive sign that a real thing is in existence. That is, Vaishnavas, we are in the Madhurya connection, in the sense that we understand that you can have various types of personal sweet relationships with the Lord when one is no longer bound by material consciousness, material gratification, etc. And then we were just showing how this trend, this deep trend, can be found in all religious traditions, in the topmost tastes of that tradition. One will find discussions on vital mysticism, or being the spouse of the Lord, or relating to the Lord in a rather friendly way, confidential way, as one's beloved. And of course, there are many different rasas, because one can be the friend of God, and one can be the parent, and one can be the servant, as well as the lover. So, I wrote this with the idea of using some of the points for our last chapter in our book, because I was also in that meditation, but thinking, but why speak about such things? Will not be understood. And at the same time, seeing how Srila Prabhupada has written the Krishna book, which talks about the Rasalila, and how Jiva Goswami, Rupa Goswami, Vishnu Chakravarti, all many great saints in our line, that they, of course, have touched upon such things, but have always warned the entities that it cannot be understood by the conditioned soul. Also, we see that the devotees who write the most about these kind of understandings are themselves celibates. And so, vigili have nothing to do with material sex life. But at the same time, they are the foremost writing about spiritual union, the foremost writing about the gopis, the foremost writing about the rapture of the soul, etc., with the beloved. So that in itself really helps us understand that it's not just a material thing, because it's a material thing, then they would be so actively involved at this particular time in their life, in physical sea bodies. But of course, it's the opposite. So I am writing this short meditation so that it goes for our book The Beggar, while you have it now for discussion, as well as some aspects for concluding our book, Spiritual Warrior II, Lust, Transforming Lust into Love. Just realizing, one, how people are suffering so much because of improper relationships, unhealthy relationships. People are suffering so much because they are in need of relationship, want to access the deeper, or access a partner. And when they do get a partner, they're in anxiety because it's not working out. And based on that, we became more inspired to speak on these different topics that we had at different times, in relationship to unconditional love, celibacy, and real love versus lust, transforming that lust into love. And now some small points about sex life versus spiritual union. Material sex life versus spiritual union. My dear soul, now that I, the physical, and keep in mind, one of the things that unfolds as we go from spiritual life in a regulated sense to experiencing higher connections, understanding more about the soul, is that we begin to see ourselves totally different, to the point that we understand that the body is like a thing of its own, doing its own stuff, and the mind intelligence is doing its thing, and the soul is watching it. And so we begin to see ourselves as like different distinct beings operating within the same space, so to speak. And that's why in many of these meditations I'm using two of the aspects of the soul speaking to the physical. The soul me speaking to the physical me. I'm trying to help you to address the soul you versus the physical you. Because when we separate the mind from ourselves, we'll be less distracted by the dictates of the mind. We're able to realize that we're really something higher than the intelligence, the senses, and the mind. Then we can begin to become much more, we begin to activate the soul more, or be able to experience the activations of the soul. So in this situation, we're looking at the illusion versus the real, then this significant meditation is important. The material me versus the spiritual. My dear soul, now that I, the physical, have begun to know and to communicate with you, the spiritual I have a few questions. We all like to try and ask ourselves that. Once you could really get a grip of who you really are, you ask that other person who's the imposter some of the heavy questions. They've been the king or the queen for quite a while. I have a few questions which only you can answer. Here in the mature world, everyone is intoxicated by sex life. We said most people think about sex every single day, in some cases many times in a day. Most people think about it every day. Most advertisements capitalize on this by feeding that intoxication. When one is around the opposite sex, one feels such pulling of the senses. For others, they are stimulated by the same sex, or in some cases, by both sexes. People who are gay, or people who are bisexual. And of course, even sex with animals and insects, sex with their own children, sex with animals. Some of the greatest art creations are expressions of subliminal as well as overt sex affiliations, with some of the greatest material creations, poetic, literary, sometimes even constructions in the arts. sculptures, buildings, dramas, are all expressions, subliminal expressions, not even more overt, of sex desire, sex affiliations, sex attachments. The basic goal of education, wealth, fame, and prestige is to better facilitate one's sex appetite. If you had to just really make mature life in its most simplistic form, you'll find that education, that fame, prestige, wealth, ultimately comes down to, for the average person, of facilities to enhance their sexual realm. It gives them greater chance for a better partner, gives them greater chance to accommodate sensual pleasures according to their desires and aspirations. My dear soul, adultery, prostitution, incest are so common, one can see that in the near future, all three will be accepted as orthodox. The demons are gradually pushing this already. They're blasting people's conscience so much with these things that after a while, we will not see it in our time, but it looks like it may, that people will feel that it is okay to have incest. Just like they did the same thing with abortion. It wasn't so long ago that the majority of people in America and most places in the world was totally against abortion. They saw it as evil, as wicked, and even if they did it completely surreptitiously, secretively. But then the demons had such a way of bringing it so much forth that later people became insensitive, or they began to think that it was okay. They put in certain couch terminology or jargon, eliminate the tissue. They began to put it in terms of rights. Women should have their rights. They have their own say-so about their body. They couch it in such a way that it began to take people's conscience away from the fact that they are murderers and they're murdering the most helpless child that they've invited, now they've murdered. And so gradually the same thing will happen. So many of these sexual deviations that it will be considered to be orthodox, and people who don't play into it will be considered to be stagnant or old-fashioned, archaic, not liberated, etc. We go on. Rapes and even murders are increasing daily as people cannot control their agitation. Leaders sacrifice their kingdoms and careers rather than withdraw from their connections with their illicit sex needs. History has constantly shown that many, many years, all different times in history, have lost everything, men as well as women, because of not being able to control their passions or because of their interest in illicit sex partners, even though they have wife or husband. Just by seeing others, even animals, engaging in the sex act, one becomes captivated and stimulated. Just by watching insects, watching animals, one in the human form will feel sexually agitated by watching the sex act go on, even though it's just insects or just animals. Stimulation. Seriously, please let me know how this has come about. In other words, with so many rapes, and people think about sex every day, and be agitated by seeing animals, and how the demons are using it in such a way, but then we are asking the soul, the physical is asking the soul. So you can answer these questions. Why? How? How this come about? Please let me know how this has come about so I can better understand how I can free myself and others from this plague that infects everyone, especially in Kali Yuga. We are a civilization that is controlled by the genitals. It is as if the genitals are the heart and the brain of the body. The heart, you know, the central organ, the brain is the central organ. But people are so much guided by the genitals that it's as if they are processing everything through the genitals. Everything passes through them. All thoughts, concerns, and aspirations must first and last consider their gratification, stimulation, and satisfaction. In other words, it's like when the heart receives blood is pumping throughout the whole body. From the brain, so much is happening to move all the organs. But we're saying that it is as if the genital has become the super organ. And that from that, everything you see, do, experience, think about, reflect on, is so much to do with what is going to be the gratification, stimulation, satisfaction relationship to stimulation of the genitals. The physical me has come to understand that Jesus instructed his followers that they should be celibate like him. He said, better to marry than to burn. Then in the Bhagavad Gita, it is explained that sex life is maithunya agara, in Sanskrit, which means the shackles that bind us in the material world. The Bhagavad Gita is so heavy about this. Bhagavad Gita says, you know, the major shackles, ropes, chains, that keeps us in the material world is this tenacious attachment to sex life. And that if one can ultimately give up sex life, physical sex life, 50% of one's liberation is obtained. In other words, if one is just able to control, restrict from physical sex life, 50% of everything else is needed to be able to go back to the kingdom of God. 50% is automatically established. Also, I understand that sex addiction is a major means of holding on to the bodily conception of life. Holding on to the reflection, illusion, rather than the real. So something, you see sometimes people are addicted to something that's artificial. So why do you want to give that up and get the real thing? Well, the artificial is preoccupying their mind, their senses, their time, and so therefore that has become a substitute. And once you have a substitute, then there's less zeal or desire for the genuine. The soul, the spiritual me, again, responded, it is not that sex life is in itself an evil. Not that sex life is evil. It's existing. And it's existing in everybody's consciousness, in all species' consciousness. Although most species have a time for sex life. Apparently every species has a time. It's not that other species are trying to have sex every day or every week. Most species are not like that, only human. I think the baboon. Well, most other species is doing mating season, mating time, they send out the signals, and then they make connection. But human species, that strength is there, facility is there, then they will pursue on both sides. So it is not that sex life is evil, because we see that every species is engaged. And we see that it is something that is in existence, and from sex life comes procreation. After all, Krishna himself says in Bhagavad Gita, he explains to Arjuna how he is that sex life which is according to religious principles. Meaning that it is possible to be in the illusory situation, to be operative in the illusory situation, but to engage in that in a way that it doesn't perpetuate the illusion. Therefore, it is explained that sex life for procreation, where one is ready to honor the accountability, be accountable, where one is not just involved in sex machines, machines coming for sensual pleasure, but that it is an actual expression of a connection that's based on an offering to the Supreme. Then Krishna is saying that he is actually honoring such sex life, even though it's in the mature world. The problem is those on the bodily platform are trying to have union without union. If you cannot understand, but who is heading to me? Those on the bodily platform are trying to have union without union. You can understand some of that. Is that people are trying to come together to have union without knowing who they are, without knowing who the partner is, They're thinking that they're the physical body. They're thinking that life is just about personal gratification and stimulation. And at best, they're mutually agreeing to selfishly stimulate each other. Because a little knowledge of the soul, little to do with sometimes even what can come from that which is natural. Because then they take to abortion or contraception, etc. So trying to have union without union. In the most confidential and highest aspect of all bona fide religious traditions, there's discussion about real union, i.e. spiritual union. One will find such discussions in sacred teachings of the Kabbalah, because we said that in the various traditions as well as Vedic tradition, that one has to qualify before even thinking about such things. So in the Judaic tradition, one must study the Torah for at least 40 years before one is supposed to read the Kabbalah. And there's certain aspects of the Kabbalah that talks something about Marbuya or conjugal rights or being associated with God as a beloved. So some aspects of Yusufism. As we said in the Songs of Songs or the discussion of the Songs of Solomon in the Bible, discusses vital mysticism. In other words, the natural activities of the soul is always to be in rapture with the beloved and to be experiencing the stimulation relationships based on that oneness, that togetherness. So it's not that it is like the animals who make union when they're in heat, or like humans who make union or try to have sex life whenever they feel some passion. But we're saying that is a reflection of a real situation with the soul, where the soul is not looking for, but the soul is always in that connection. We're always experiencing the ecstasy of the beloved. And when making arrangements, which we call Vipalamba, that there is even a greater connection of that union, even though there is separation. It makes no sense in the material sense. That when there is so-called separation that doesn't exist, when there is a reflection of separation, there's a greater connection of that union when thinking of so-called separation than when there is the union without thinking of separation. Don't worry. My soul, the spiritual continuum. So the spiritual me talking to the physical me. And this is written in such a way to draw, again, the dichotomy between material sex and spiritual union, or draw the dichotomy that there is a physical counterpart of everyone, and there is a spiritual counterpart. And they're both real, but functioning in different ways. This is why we can understand that the desires we have, or the anxiety and the stimulation we have for sex life, is a real thing, because it's a reflection of something that's super real. And that where the avoidance try to eliminate all desire. We don't want to eliminate desire. To be desireless is to be dead. To be alive, revived in some way, there's always some desires. It's a matter of understanding, codifying the desires, or channeling those desires in the proper way. Somebody who's trying to stop all sex desire, stop all desires for pleasure, stop all desires for union, stop all desires for relationship, they will just become a mad person. You know? Because the soul is active. It's in relationship. And it's wanting to have the highest expression of relationship. Not no relationship, but wants the highest. My soul, the spiritual continuum. This sex life, with the soul talking to the material me, this sex life in the material world, i.e. bodily consciousness, can bring all kinds of social disturbing consequences, such as unwanted pregnancy, illegitimate children, abortion, venereal diseases, etc. Listen closely, my beloved. This is the soul talking, the physical me. For although you will not be able to understand these additional remarks, For as long as you and others are embodied, it is almost impossible to fully understand transcendental affairs. But nevertheless, listen attentively. For one day soon, it shall all be commonplace to you. Like somebody tell me about something, and they say, well, let me give you a preview. Well, it won't make much sense, but soon it will make some sense. So later, put a few puzzle pieces together, it will make sense. So then we go on. Union in the spiritual realm has nothing to do with physical bodies or genitals trying to stimulate and then calling this union. For union in the spiritual world, in spiritual bodies, it is not limited to genital searching for contact, but all aspects of the spiritual body, i.e. all parts engaged in a union or in a collective union. Read that over again. Union in the spiritual world, in spiritual bodies, is not limited to the genitals searching for contact or genital stimulation, but all aspects of the spiritual body, that is, all aspects of the soul, all parts engaged in a union, individual union with the beloved, or collective union. As a matter of fact, in the spiritual body, one sense can perform the activities of all other senses. You begin to see an immediate difference. In the material body, one sense does one thing, is stimulated in one way, relates in one way. In the spiritual body, the soul, every sense can perform the activities of any other sense. And when one has union, other souls can experience that union. Doesn't make any sense, but just try to hear it. This is the nature of true loving connections, in contrast to self-centered, lustful associations. Now let's help us understand what we can understand, so we understand something. Just like in a relationship where there's a lot of compassion, or there's strong comradeship, strong fraternity, strong sororityhood, then when something happens to one person, others who are closely connected with that person, they also feel exhilarated and stimulated, even though it didn't happen to them. Somebody you really care for, something wonderful happened to them, and you also feel so happy. You feel rejuvenated, you feel stimulated, even though it happened to somebody else, but because you were so intricately connected that you're experiencing some of the pleasure, and sometimes as much or more pleasure as the person who it happened to. You have a little son, you have a daughter, you have a close friend. Somebody tell me they wanted for a long time, somehow it's come upon them. They got a scholarship, you know, to the university. They found, you know, some money. They are chronically ill, and all of a sudden they got, spontaneous remission, and the disease just disappeared. And they are happy as hell. Huh? But you heard about it, and you are just as happy as they are, even more happy, because you care about them so much. So in spiritual union, that one person's association, happiness, service, stimulates another person just as if it is happening to them. And sometimes even more so, they are being affected. It's explained in the Purana that the gopis the manjaris who are serving Srimati Radharani, that they are enjoying even millions of times more than Krishna. Or that they are enjoying just as they are arranging things for Srimati Radharani. Or they are enjoying just as they are arranging things for each other, they are experiencing as much or more, even though they are seemingly not the participants. That is a union that seemingly is in separation, but not. This is the nature of true loving connections, in contrast to self-centered, lustful connections, where one is just concerned, of course, about their own happiness, pleasure, stimulation. Sex in the spiritual body in contrast to material sex life, it's like the difference between water and oil. Think about that. Difference between water and oil. Yes, they are both liquids, but they are highly different. Or like a sane man versus an insane man. They're both men, but their awareness and consciousness is totally different. Water and oil, liquids, yes, seem to be similar because they're liquids. But you drink oil and you will die. Huh? You go without water for so many, so long, take a few weeks and you also die. Same man who is completely impractical, not grounded, not identifying with so-called reality, and a sane man who is sensitive, responding based on natural input. Both men, but totally different. But the sane man try to understand, I'm sorry, the insane man try to understand the sane man, a whole different level. They are not only seeing the world differently, but they're also responding to it differently. And then lastly here, another example is the difference between a free man or a noble, righteous citizen in contrast to a vicious, impersonal criminal. These men are not only governed by different laws, but they have a different field of activity. Okay? Criminal is governed by the prison, by the state, by the warden. Free man, they're both eating, sleeping, mating, defending. They're both working. They're both influenced by certain laws, but different laws. So the same. Spiritual union, spiritual sex, somewhat similar, but different in these ways. These men are not governed by different, they're not only governed by different laws, they have a different field of activity. But the prisoner's lifestyle and environment is perverted expression of the actual society. This is probably the closest way to better understand. But the prisoner is in a society, but it's a perverted reflection. And the more you understand prison life, the more you see. Cigarettes become money. And certain things become prestige. That a certain type of person becomes a lovemate. So you have all different, you know, culture going on. But it's prison. And you have culture, but now it's free culture. When the prisoner forgets about his incarceration and tries to enjoy in the prison, continuing on his sinful nature of other criminals, they each forfeit their parole. So when these physical bodies, we're in a prison, and we keep on identifying with the physical culture of the senses, then we forfeit our ability to be free. And so we then keep running after the illusion, the artificial, which is there, but it's temporary. It's stimulating, but it's temporary, and it's consequent. So when the conditioned soul tries to enjoy sex life, especially outside of religious principles, he or she extends their period of incarceration in the material body, in the material world. When there's adultery, there's fornication, there's illicit sex, then, even though one is pursuing for pleasure, one is pursuing for happiness, then the consequences are the opposite. One is extending their sentence in the realm of illusion. So my soul then concluded by saying, as we have more of these conversations, the soul is talking to the physical me. As you continue to advance in spiritual life, you shall give up the illusion of separateness, and we shall reclaim our own union. See, at a certain point, when the physical you or the physical me no longer is the physical you or the physical me, it merges, it has union, it completely integrates into the spiritual you. And therefore, that physical that was distraction, holding on to the illusion, now is no longer having its own identity, but now it has become a part or integrated into the whole, the real you, and that's ultimate union of being freed of conditioned life. But now, it's the soul no longer having to wait and look on the nonsense of the spiritual or the physical body, the physical mind and senses, constantly in anxiety and agitation. When this happens, you shall clearly understand how the materialists are trying to have union without union. And later, when you fully return to the spiritual world, you shall discover how everything is in blissful union, constantly preparing for greater and more explosive, ecstatic union. So, that's it. So, we're just trying to explain something. Cannot be fully explained, but help you to understand, or you can understand it, at the same time, to help you to appreciate, based on certain analogies, about the realm that we're trying to address in relationship to the soul. See, sometimes we think we can understand something fully, we won't understand it at all. But we understand that it's not so easy to understand, almost impossible, we won't understand enough. So what we really did was help you to understand or not, letting you understand that you can understand, giving you a chance to reflect on it, so that what is a little bit, let's say, a little bit appreciative, that we can appreciate, we will hold on or capture the moment based on that, that we can, you know, that we can appreciate. It's like the example of the frog in the well, where the frog is keeps using his own example of trying to see how big something is. So if we are thinking that we can understand something based on just our normal paradigm, then we won't understand anything at all, we really appreciate it. We realize our present paradigm can't really grasp the full essence, then that won't be distracting. And there will be some level of appreciation. So what we're really talking about is that we can appreciate this even though we can't understand it. So any questions?
Yes. In relationship to what you were saying, thought came to mind. Could you explain the difference? You were talking about self-realization and like God-realization. You draw the distinction.
There's a difference. Just like there's a difference, the different types of transcendentalists. That in Bhagavatam is referred to three different levels. Brahmaniti, Paramatmaniti, Bhagavaniti. Emphasizing that three types of realizations take place as we transcend the material modes of nature or the material world. And the first is recognizing the universality of all things. This is sometimes referred to as cosmic consciousness, universal intelligence, samadhi, where we are recognizing the interconnection of all things, experiencing the cosmic connection. That is transcendent, the physical. And then next is paramatmani, is experiencing the sovereignty of the soul and the connection of the soul with the paramatma, or the super soul. So the Judeo-Christian tradition is referring to as having some experience and connection with the Holy Ghost. So one aspect of this title, mysticism, is a marriage versus a betrothal. And in a marriage where there's the reflection of the soul meeting the super soul and having like a marriage, a connection of acceptance, in that sense. And so that is a soul where, again, transcending the material body, material consciousness. Then there is the Bhagavaniti, where we're talking about in Vaishnava connection, realizing that there is spiritual variegatedness, that there is much greater than just the breaking of the material, and then everything is in principle. The Shivites, the Shaktis, the impersonals, the Mayavadis, etc., so they also are experiencing or are aware of something outside of material, but the idea is material is temporary or is illusion, and therefore behind that is the principle. You break something down and we have the principle of that, and therefore they see that as the God. And for the Vaishnava, that one actually experiences pain even to hear someone speak like that. This is why sometimes the Vaishnava also may seem almost to be like a fanatic. Sometimes one is a fanatic, it is an ill fight. But sometimes a Vaishnava may also be very advanced to seem like a fanatic, because it's like someone who is in love with a person and someone else is saying they don't exist. It's just a myth. Or their clothes only exist. Or the song they made only exists. And that gives you pain because you know the song and the clothes is there because it's connected with the person who uses those things. And they think about the person, if you think about the things without the person, you, it's just mind-boggling, disturbing because of the love you have for the person who's a user. And it's like denying your beloved and just thinking or only wanting to reflect on some manifestations or some paraphernalia used by the beloved. So sometimes Vaishnavas, when they hear impersonal philosophy being spoken, sometimes they leave the place, and they put their fingers in their ears, or sometimes they speak out to defeat the situation because it actually can give them pain because of the level of love that they have. So these are the three levels of transcendence. Other questions?
Not quite how to formulate this, but I've always had a difficulty understanding Raghunuga Bhakti.
Okay.
And is it something that we don't, you know, I mean, I know we're focused on sadhana bhakti.
So what it is? We say sadhana or vaidhi bhakti?
What's the question?
What is Raghunuga Bhakti?
I mean, I understand what it is, but I don't know if is there some at one point a transcendence from Sadhana Bhakti to Raghunuga, or?
Well, the Raghunuga Bhakti platform goes beyond regimentation of rules and regulations. In other words, sometimes we explain how it's not that when we go to the spiritual world, we have to chant 16 rounds, we have to go to Mangalarti. We have to worship Dalsi. We have to honor, Akadasis and things like that. These are things that are designed to help us in the conditioned state to be able to purify our senses and to help us while we're in the material body to cope with having to deal with material culture, but to be less affected by it. But once there's no longer the physical you and the spiritual you, or the physical me and the spiritual I, then that dichotomy doesn't exist. So therefore one doesn't have to be having certain times that they're calling on God's name, because they will always be absorbed in the calling of the Lord. Always be absorbed in anticipating, you know, service, ready to do service. An example is when you're sick and you take precaution, you take medicine. When you're healthy, you don't have to do all those same things, because now you don't need that. That was to build you up. That was to relieve the disease, take out the foreign matter. So Raghunuga Bhakti is the platform of spontaneity, and it gives more attention to the activities of the soul. And it also is a platform where one doesn't have to take the medicine the same way, to the point one doesn't take medicine at all. But the Nectar Devotion explains that it's somehow a sadhaka, or aspiring person is engaged in the process of Vaidhi Bhakti, Sadhana Bhakti, and comes to the level where they are now fully pure, that they should go on still acting as if they're still conditioned, still taking the medicine, so that it doesn't confuse others. And it also eliminates those who want to profess to be on that level who are not. Because one who even is still supposed to go on and act for the example, encouragement, and the guidance of others. But the Raghunuga also deals a lot with the rapture of the soul. And as we mentioned, it's dangerous to speak about such because then people just think that the prison life is not different than the real, than freedom. And so, therefore, it's discussed in a very delicate way. And that's why we say how some of the topmost Christians of different traditions will notice from their writings and their realizations, they will allude or talk about such things. Other questions? Yes.
I guess my question is the love that you're talking about, is it qualitatively different? Because it seems like there are examples where, for instance, a mother would dive into a river to save her drowning child. You know, is it that there's a quantitative difference or a qualitative difference? Or is it because we hear about, well, there's, you know, transcendental anger and then there's the kind of anger we feel?
So both, it's not. The question is showing the lack of knowledge. The question is showing deep perception. Yes, there. Sometimes you hear the preaching that there's no love in the material world. That is spoken in contrast that the ultimate love is so deep that what we call love would be considered on a scale where we consider to be pain. But it's not that there isn't actual love in the material world. There is. But it's just temporary. Or it's not so consistent. Or it's not, it's nothing. It's not eternal. So we are seeing glimpses. Even sometimes, even in a relationship of partners, a man and woman. And not only to that of a selfishness shown with mother or father with their child. That's a little more classical. Because it's a love that's unconditional. It's not, nothing, one is not expecting something. Normally in a husband and woman, a husband and wife relationship, something's expected on both sides. Something seriously is expected. It's a relationship and it's a contract and it's a business arrangement also. But there is the flickering expressions of love, just that is not fully explosive. Other questions? Yes,
when you were talking about Robin Luther, it was always thinking of the Lord. And I think in even answering Elisha, that whole loving aspect. I remember at a class in my school when they were talking about hearing, how important hearing is. When you hear about the Lord, it gets to the heart and eventually that love awakens and we have that closeness. My question is, and I think that since it's in the scriptures and it's taught, it must be possible to always think of the Lord while shopping and cleaning and washing and cooking and discussion, so that we are no longer bound by material existence, as you said. How I've been trying, it's difficult, I don't think I'm there, nowhere near, but how does one acquire that, especially after hearing so much and realizing, feeling, it's just true, and this can happen now.
By practice? There's two parts of that question, two parts to answer. This Prabhupada mentioned how when we hear the pastime of Krishna, the gopis in the Krishna book, that one who's feeling lust, that one can be relieved of lust plus fulfillment. But also, we see that it can cause you to feel it, you know, lusty also, because it can be put into material paradigm. So by hearing, some effect takes place. Now by always thinking of the Lord, Ravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu, Swanam, always thinking, remembering, it does not mean that we have to be thinking about particular pastimes. We may or may not. But just thinking about the service that I have for my guru, or thinking about the mission of my spiritual life, or thinking about doing this with devotion, and having a chance to struggle and to make this as an offering, then that is not different. That is also the mood of always thinking about the Lord. his service. He's always thinking about Krishna. He's always thinking about Krishna in terms of his, we call guna, rupa, lila. It means thinking about his pastimes, thinking about his form, thinking about the activities, thinking about the devotees, engaged in the devotional service, all of these things with intensity. Well, we are more and more putting the physical me or I away, and then become more spiritualized. And then what happens? The physical I and the spiritual I begin to come together, because then there's less and less of the stuff for the physical to hang on to. And then once there's less and less obstacles, less and less distractions, then all of the activities of the soul, which is already one's rightful claim, one begins to experience. So maybe we'll stop there.
Just let me follow up on that. That's very helpful. Where I need the help, or it seems I need the help, is how to keep that thought pattern when it comes to our devotees. And I say that because today I went through, that by 2 o'clock, this room was almost empty and devotees weren't here. And I'm trying to see them as spirit soul, but I was very upset and very angry that they would not come out when we were here, at least, and be here on time. And I went through it. And then my thing is, you know, we're all under your shelter. There has to be some way, because you've told me not to let the devotees upset me, but I still allow it. How can I take that feeling to a higher level? Because, you know, I'm trying not to shake anybody, they're not my children. But to when I see that kind of what appears to be, how do I stay in a balanced plane and still remember Krishna and embrace?
We were kind of riding a little bit of a cloud and you just brought it down, which is good. It's down to the hard realities. Right? So we can be able to, in the lecture, develop our framework. So it's sort of similar to the darshan we gave that we asked the devotees to hear, which hopefully we saw some tapes, the darshan that we had, that you had yesterday morning, and we gave the tapes out from Yanagi darshan. And part of that darshan I was explaining to the devotees that we can see ourselves as servants, we can go beyond that. This again is also Rastapa. We can see ourselves in the mood of mother to the child or father to the child. Your servant, you can do it or not do it. Somebody else can do it. It may happen. You may put it off, etc. But if you're looking at it in terms of your duty as a mother or a father to a small child, then you're in the mood of, if I don't do it, the child will die. If I don't do it, the child will starve. If I don't do it, what will happen to my child? So we should take on our own responsibilities in that particular move. Not to become oblivious to others, we should consider that here's my chance to serve Guru, here's my chance to serve devotees, here's my chance to do this or do that. Let me do my part. And others may do and they may not do. But we can't get too upset about that. If we get too upset about somebody else not doing, then we'll also lose our enthusiasm. Or if we wait on somebody else to do, then we'll also be a procrastinator. That doesn't mean that we're impersonalists and we don't try to encourage. You do. You have a daughter or a son who's very small, a baby. You do encourage other people to try to watch the baby. You do encourage somebody maybe to clean the baby or to feed the baby. But the real concern is that each person is thinking, I must do it because it's my baby. So if we look at it in that way, our service will take a whole higher level. And then if many people do like that, an amazing amount of the quality of service, and listening, hearing, will be phenomenal. And if we think that way, if many people are thinking that way, then it will raise the atmosphere so that when those who are not able to do or who are procrastinating, they will also become more inspired. Because people have different reasons why they can come and not come, that's there. They have different priorities, that's there. But of course, these are very important times and we want people to try to hear. And hopefully those who are not, they have very good reasons. Not everybody knows spiritual mind. And those who do not come and then they don't even try to get the tapes, then they're not taking the whole process seriously. If somebody's not taking the process serious, then do you decide well, if you're not going to change the diapers of my baby, then I'm not going to do anything. You don't do that. Or if you say, well, I've asked you to feed my child or watch the child, and I come back and I see you didn't do it, then you decide, well, I'm not going to watch the kid either. I'm going to show you. I'm going to show you, huh? And the poor kid died. And then they look around and say, what happened? Well, I just wanted to show you. What happens? The people do like what you do. See? So you see what happened? You didn't do it, now you do it. I look, the baby's dead. See? Now you already see. What that mentality means. Then your baby's dead. No, we don't do like that, you know. explaining those tapes that I was mentioning about getting out of your sense. I'm not looking for somebody else to come and make the project happen. I'm looking at, here's my chance to make this an offering to Srila Prabhupada. And if other people come, if other situations connect, then that's a bonus. So we have to be thinking, I'm going to be here to hear. I'm going to do this service, I'll do that service. And hopefully more people will do, but if not, I'm going to see how I do my service so well that it will encourage the other services, or will bring more people to come, it will be like this, like that. And then you take it all from a perspective where it's a growth experience and accelerates your conscience and others also. Otherwise, you know, one can be very, you know, kind of depressed, and then they'll lose their own enthusiasm. And managers, that happens a lot. One of the dangers in management is you got to oversee, you got to coordinate, you got to encourage. And the tendency is one gets drained in trying to encourage others. And then the next thing is the person thinks, well, I'm going to kind of chill out also. Or I'm going to, you know, take my distance. Otherwise I see that it is going to pile more and more on me. You think? It's going to get more and more stuff to me. And so, I'm not going to do it either. So I'll get the example of the kids who are massaging their father. And while they're massaging their father, some father's laying down in the bed, they're massaging his legs, massaging his feet. And then, they start fighting, you know. They're throwing blows all over the place. And it's knocking the hell out of the father, you know. And so in the process of them fighting, the father is suffering. So their own anxiety causing so much trouble to the one that's supposed to be serving, you know, the one that's supposed to be loving. So if somebody's not doing, then who's going to suffer? Mm-hmm. Like I was just trying to explain this to Kabir, and I was speaking about the fact that I didn't even start running cake, for example. And I actually the other day, and she said I had taken some of the tapes to, you know, for videoing for the stations. And so I was explaining that it's not just a tape. Huh? Not just for getting a tape, but not getting somebody to drive you to a station, is that you stop hundreds of people from being able to hear the message about Krishna and the message the spiritual master is trying to give. So it's not just a thing where, you know, weeks and weeks go and then you don't get the tapes on, but now we're on one of the stations every other week because of also not the video crew or the timing situation not being sharp on top of it. So therefore what happens then is that some people who maybe was turning in thinking that, well, I can come on every day at that time, you turn on once, they don't see it, and they don't respond. So it's like thinking of warfare, you know, or realizing how each thing has such an effect in so many different ways. As we do that, we're able to understand more beyond our discussion, just the separated and the material. We separate it, we think, this is a tape, this is a video, and I don't have time to do it because I gotta do this thing. Later I'll try to find some time to do this, when you realize that my life is for preaching and whatever I'm doing is supposing for elevation, for liberation, for service to Guru. Guru's always with me. Mm-hmm. Therefore you're thinking, now it becomes more easy. You'll see that here is now Guru's service and now a chance to think of Krishna, think of Guru, serve people. So we lose that separateness, then we literally become more spiritual. And all this we're talking about, that there's ongoing union with the soul, and that one sense performs the activities of all other senses, is really the idea that we're no longer fragmenting our consciousness, fragmenting our existence, and operating on so many levels, being a slave of these different agencies, these different parts of us pulling, but now we're integrated, and we're now becoming more and more the exhilarated soul that we really are. And that is what the major discussion is about. Pure sex life versus spiritual union. The spiritual union is not just genitals or organs trying to make a connection. It's about one's entire existence being able to be in the most sublime relationship with the object of everyone's love. And it's not only about that living entity in their relationship with God. Because we're explaining how one person who's just assisting in the service experiences as much or more happiness as the person who's receiving the service. But we don't begin to experience that until we're able to practice more. And we're practicing really just by our day-to-day interactions. We're practicing trying to be selfless. We're practicing trying to do things and be aware that it's Guru and Krishna service. We're practicing by trying to see everyone in a mood of not getting distracted by the separateness that's there. So we're practicing by not being race conscious, gender conscious, by being elitist conscious. We're practicing by not being nationalistic. We're practicing by not being religiously sectarian. We're practicing by doing this religious exercise, literally addressing that separateness, addressing physical and its realm, and seeing that that's there, but it's temporary. Focusing back on and drawing things back to the spiritual. But the more we can do that in such a way that it's not just theoretical, but we become that. We realize, I am the soul, and I got a body that I'm using. I have some senses that I'm using, and they're giving me hell, but I'm using this. I got to make the best of a bad bargain, but I am beyond it. And I'm going to reclaim my real heritage of what I am. I'm more than a queen. I'm more than a king. I'm much more than that. Sometimes people have that idea, that they're stately. Their soul is much more than that. Much, much more. Completely, it's not completely eternal. And it's completely experiencing the bliss that we're always trying to run after, that we're trying to grab, just getting some flickering of that. That is all of our original heritage. When you think about it, spiritual life is wonderful because we're really going for the topmost instructions. And we're ready to pay a little bit of price for austerity and making this a process of evaluation and taking the medication because we are not satisfied with any temporary situations that later lead into disappointment. And how we practice now determines how much we will unfold into the actual eternal experiences. Jai!